EFT, and the Champaign Park District. Looking for something fun to do this weekend? The Champaign Park District's Weekend Explorer email comes out every Thursday, jam-packed with ideas, events, and programs for each upcoming weekend. Information on subscribing to the Weekend Explorer can be found at champaignparks.org.
Okay, and here is the aforementioned Asada Shakur on Mumia, and then we'll hear a commentary from Mumia himself about another brave woman on the front of a fight for human rights, I guess I'll say.
Appeal to you, sisters and brothers, to fight tooth and nail to save Mumia's life and to free him from the grips of his oppressors. As you honor our forefathers and foremothers, I urge you to honor our living heroes. When you honor the names of Nat Turner, Harriet Tubman, and Malcolm X, I urge you to honor the names of Geronimo Gijaga, Sundiata Okoli, Mutulu Shakur, and Mumia Abu-Jamal. I urge you not to forget and not to betray our living heroes. If we ignore their struggle, we are ignoring our own. If we betray our living history, then we are betraying ourselves. We could not save Malcolm X, but we can save Mumia. We can save him, and we must save him. Because we love our brother, and we need our brother to help us fight for freedom. Free Mumia Abu-Jamal. Free all political prisoners. Let us carry on our tradition to freedom.
Okay, that was actually from 21, and a lot of people are commenting on her passing right now. Another interesting case. I've been thinking that maybe they didn't test her her hands for gunshot residue either, as they didn't for Mumia himself. It's a kangaroo court, as you might expect. So here is, we'll try again to get this directly on the air.
What is happening in the world today, especially in America? Believe it or not, it has happened before, but only if we really honestly study our history and see it with clear eyes. After the U.S. Civil War, the deadliest war in U.S. history, the South, the loser in the war, struggled to win the tenuous peace by waging war against Reconstruction, the U.S. government plan to give black folks their rights to American citizenship. White terrorists waged war against these newly freed people by making their citizenship empty and meaningless. They were attacked at their jobs, assaulted in the streets, and denied their right to vote, to serve on juries, or to join unions. The country that wrote, approved, and signed the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution into law then proceeded to ignore it for over 100 years when it came to the rights, privileges, and immunities of black people in America. That's because what ruled the U.S. wasn't the Constitution. It was unwritten rules of white supremacy. Any country that can ignore its own Constitution for over 100 years can do anything. For what did the Constitution mean for black folks? It meant nothing. What mattered above all else was whiteness. It took decades of struggles of the black freedom movement to put a dent in the long, dirty history of white terrorism and white supremacy. This historical rhythm has created a cycle of U.S. history and replays itself in this very hour across the nation. That's the real reasoning behind the mindless assaults on black history by the government of the U.S. They want to make black history disappear as if it didn't really happen. The late great revolutionary Dr. Frantz Fanon saw something similar during the Algerian Revolution. Fanon, speaking of the intentions of the French colonialists, wrote in his classic work, Wretched of the Earth, the following. Colonialism is not satisfied with snaring the people in a net or of draining the colonized brain of any form or substance. With a kind of perverted logic, it turns attention to the past of the colonized people and distorts it, disfigures it, and destroys it. The words of Dr. Frantz Fanon from The Wretched of the Earth. Remember this. No government can wash away the history of a people. Resolve to teach your children our people's history so it can bloom in their hearts. There it will ring within for generations. With love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Okay, well, had some trouble getting that directly on the air. I was holding up on the mic, which solves my dilemma. I was going to play something from Drop Site News about the flotilla. They had an interview on Thursday, I guess it would have dropped, about the drone that were swarming around the flotilla. I guess the Italian frigates and the Spanish were the first to announce that they were going to send a boat to go in accompaniment. And I guess they maybe are there now. Are they going to shoot down an Israeli drone or an unidentified drone? I guess if it's unidentified, it's easier to shoot down. It's been dropping incendiary devices, apparently, if I've heard. But I don't have a way of putting that excerpt on the air too easily. So I'll go with all the other accumulation of material I have. Amy Goodman dropped a number of web exclusives. Suggest you go to that site, Democracy Now! I'll play at least part of one about Microsoft caving to some pressure about their cloud programming Azure and not being allowed to be used by the Israelis to surveil people. I don't know the specifics of it, but I'll be listening closely too. Amy Goodman's commentary we'll get to right now, and that sort of frames the whole debate about Gaza. I've got some Sam Husseini from Monday. I'm going to play part of that. Some of it's a little bit anachronistic in that it talks about the upcoming Security Council meeting on Palestine and the addresses from the floor. I guess it wasn't specifically, but that was a major issue with Macron. It's interesting that Macron's advisor on the issue is a French Jewish fellow, Bronkstein maybe, and he got in trouble a while back saying if there had been a Palestinian state, October 7th probably wouldn't have happened. So I don't think that should be that controversial, I don't think. But in the current climate, of course it is. Opinions you hear here are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared. I may play a short excerpt from the discussion at the University YMCA Latzer Hall. I was really taken by this since I was a Vietnam-era protester, and there were some incredible shots, photojournalism from that era, from a guy named Bob Case. Bob Case at AOL.com. Hopefully I'll be having the PowerPoint display available for people to look through maybe while they're listening to his audio address from that talk. Hope the video turned out well, and that'll probably be on the University YMCA's own YouTube channel. But let's hear Amy break the sound barrier with this commentary. Do go to weft.org and donate. I've gotten my hands full down here, and there's nobody to answer phone calls, so I suppose I could take one during a longer segment Anyway, here's a regular feature on Saturday morning, Amy Goodman's commentary, and then I think we'll get right to her piece talking about Microsoft's change in policy, which I hadn't heard about anywhere else.
Palestinian statehood and the race to stop the Gaza genocide. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast.
Let's be clear. Statehood for the Palestinians is a right, not a reward.
So said United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, addressing the UN General Assembly's meeting on the two-state solution in Israel-Palestine. This week, 10 more nations have recognized the Palestinian state. The United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, Portugal, France, Luxembourg, Belgium, Malta, Monaco, and Andorra. Over 150 countries now recognize Palestine as a state, including 14 of 15 members of the United Nations Security Council. The only outlier, the United States, which consistently wields its Security Council veto power in defense of Israel. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, leaving Tel Aviv en route to the UN General Assembly, again rejected Palestinian statehood, vowing,
"It will not happen."
Israeli protesters gathered at the airport to denounce him. The situation in Gaza is catastrophic, with yet another report, this one from the United Nations, that Israel's committing genocide. On top of the slaughter and starvation of civilians, the Israeli military is ethnically cleansing Gaza City, a city of 1 million people, leveling it. The BBC reported Israel's far-right finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, said last week Gaza could be a real estate bonanza, adding, "We've done the demolition phase, now we need to build," unquote. The situation is dire and worsening as well in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, where a sophisticated system of apartheid has been imposed on the millions of Palestinians who've been living under Israeli military occupation since 1967. Palestinians are daily subjected to military raids, mass arrests, home demolitions, and land seizures. Israeli settlers regularly assault and kill Palestinians with complete impunity, often while Israeli soldiers look on. Illegal settlements continue to expand while new ones are built. Israel recently approved a controversial new settlement in the so-called E1 zone, which would effectively cut the West Bank in two, making a two-state solution practically impossible.
We've seen over the course of this hideous conflict the U.S.'s isolation, U.S. and Israel's isolation deepening on the world stage.
Ishan Tharoor, global affairs columnist at The Washington Post, said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
You've seen all these governments, especially now in Western Europe, recognizing that no one's under the illusion that making this move creates a Palestinian state, but it shows a level of political commitment to the Palestinians that many believe is necessary. And it's a reminder to Israel that what Israel is doing won't be ignored.
At a side event near the UN, a number of world leaders, diplomats and others gathered to honor the legacy of the late Uruguayan president José Pepe Mujica, who died last May, 1 week before his 90th birthday. Mujica was part of the broad front that resisted Uruguay's U.S.-backed dictatorship in the 70s and 80s, during which time he was imprisoned and tortured. Among those who spoke were Chilean President Gabriel Boric, Uruguayan President Yamandú Orsi, and Spanish President Pedro Sánchez. Said Sánchez,
"What would Pepe Mujica say about what's happening in Gaza? What would he feel seeing the strip turned into a cemetery for children? What would he think of a world that displays the rhetoric of human rights but allows their systematic violation? I think what Prime Minister Netanyahu is doing in Gaza is beyond words, but it has a word which defines it, and it is genocide."
Reflecting on the four decades of General Francisco Franco's dictatorship in Spain, President Sánchez said,
"We have learned to value freedom because we know the price of losing it for all of us. Today, authoritarianism once again walks arrogantly across the world."
Spain and Italy, another nation that endured decades of fascism, have dispatched naval vessels to assist the global Samud flotilla bound for Gaza. With over 40 boats of various sizes, it's the largest such aid flotilla by far. Previous flotillas have been attacked by Israel, including the 2010 attack on the Mavi Marmara, when Israel killed 9 activists, including a U.S. citizen. The current flotilla has been attacked repeatedly with explosive drones, communications jamming, and more, but no injuries yet. Israel's widely considered to be behind the attacks and hasn't denied it. David Adler of the Progressive International, on a lead boat, called into Democracy Now! From the Mediterranean Sea near Greece.
are packed to the gills with basic and critical humanitarian aid, baby formula, medicine, food, and water. However, we're not naive about the scale of the suffering in Gaza and the scale of the humanitarian crisis that requires a much larger and more ambitious response by the states whose good faith obligations under international law require them to respond under the Genocide Convention. So that's why I put so much emphasis on this infrastructural element of our mission. We are not here to drop the aid and go home and pat ourselves on the back.
We have 5 seconds,
David. We are here,
David,
to establish a humanitarian corridor for states themselves to assume their responsibilities and to deliver the aid at the scale that Gaza requires.
Adler and the flotilla activists are demonstrating a basic precept of organizing. When the people lead, the leaders will follow. Palestinian statehood is an essential goal. However, now nothing is more critical than ending Israel's U.S.-backed genocide in Gaza. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
And the Colombian president has added to the list of persona non grata for his remarks at the UN. Yeah, right. I just checked web exclusives, and Amy has a different one following the UN assembly and the speech by Netanyahu. So I'm going to put that on right now.
I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Inside the United Nations today, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave his address to the UN General Assembly. This is a part of what he said.
The final elements, the final remnants of Hamas are holed up in Gaza City. They vow to repeat the atrocities of October 7th again and again and again, no matter how diminished their forces. That is why Israel must finish the job. That is why we want to do so as fast as possible.
As Netanyahu spoke, scores of delegates walked out of the UN General Assembly. This week, Western countries like Britain and Australia, France, Portugal, Canada, Belgium, and others joined more than 150 other countries in recognizing the state of Palestine. That leaves only the United States on the UN Security Council not to have recognized Palestine. Outside the UN today, thousands protested Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Up, up with liberation!
Up, up with liberation!
Down, down with occupation!
I'm Naz Issa. I'm with the Palestinian Youth Movement, and we're here to demand the arrest of Netanyahu, the wanted war criminal, and to demand an arms embargo on Israel for its genocide against Palestinians. Well, you know, he's not going to come to the UN without meeting the resistance of this city. You know, and we're seeing, you know, that now we even have a mayoral candidate who's saying that if he's elected mayor, he won't allow Netanyahu to set foot in this city without arresting him. And so we're seeing the growing international isolation of Netanyahu, his bloc, and Israel, and that's what we're here to solidify. Symbolic rejection of Netanyahu isn't enough. Turning their backs on Netanyahu isn't enough. They need to take action as member states of the United Nations and impose real sanctions, an arms embargo, and a trade embargo on Israel.
My name is Reed Brody. I'm an international war crimes prosecutor. Benjamin Netanyahu has been indicted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes, crimes against humanity, for using starvation as a weapon of war. He is a fugitive from justice. States that are parties to the ICC have a duty to arrest him, and even states like the United States, which aren't parties, have a duty to arrest a war criminal. The United States is complicit in the war crimes being committed in Israel. The bombs that are being used to destroy Palestinian homes and schools and houses are American bombs. The campaign of extermination that Israel is carrying out is being done with American political support. The United States should be arresting him, not fighting him.
My name is Nida Alafi. I'm a member of the Palestinian Youth Movement, and I'm here with the thousands of people to say, you know, Netanyahu should not be at the UNGA. Actually, he should be tried for his crimes at The Hague. And, you know, we're all here the same way we have been for the past 2 years, demanding that governments and leaders take real action to to end the genocide that has only escalated, right? For it to have reached this level of atrocities and for him to still have a spot at the UNGA is absolutely egregious. And that's why I think now more than ever, people are more agitated. People are more angry. I mean, we see in Italy, you know, millions of people have gone on strike, right? And here the streets are filled with thousands of people when Netanyahu's room, when he was speaking to the UNGA, was mostly empty.
My name is Lita Hirschman Levy, and I'm a member of Jewish Voice for Peace. I'm disgusted that our country would allow this war criminal here. There is no reason for him to be here. He should be locked up. He should not have any power as far as I'm concerned. He is a war criminal. He is perpetuating and creating a genocide in Gaza. He is murdering thousands of Palestinians. This is not in the name of Jewish safety. It is goes against everything that Judaism stands for. I'm horrified that this is happening in my name as a Jewish person. I'm the descendant of Holocaust survivors. My grandparents were Holocaust survivors. He is not welcome here. He is a war criminal, and this has to end. Palestine needs to be free, liberated, with the right to return home.
I'm Margaret. I met up with the Democratic Socialists of America contingent this morning. I wanted to come and, like, express my disgust that this war criminal is in our city, that a lot of these war criminals are in our city, and dare to show their faces in public after the, like, crimes that we've seen against the Palestinian people, people all across the Middle East, and people all, like, under the boot of imperialism all over the world. I don't have any time for these so-called great men. I only have a message for, like, people, which is that we are all the same. We are all together in this, and these capitalists, these war criminals and war profiteers, they do not represent us. And Netanyahu, yeah, there was always going to be someone who was going to be the head of that state. We had to have someone like Trump, and isn't he the perfect manifestation of, you know, American id as well? I don't care about them. It's about the, like, world struggle.
My name is Jane Hirschman, and my grandson, who's 4.5 months, is named Jack Clyburn Hirschman. And what I want to say is, my grandson can have formula. He can have good health care. He has a safe house to live in, not a tent. What is happening in Gaza? Netanyahu is killing babies, killing these kinds of wonderful babies who should have a life ahead of them, who should be able to go to school, see a doctor, have formula, have clothing.
Indeed, and Medicine Sans Frontières has closed their operations in Gaza City because they are surrounded by Israeli forces. That was pretty breathless. Here's a little more dispassionate product from Amy Goodman. Obviously, as usual, I've got much more than I can get on the radio. And I have be preempted tomorrow. I'll be happy to be at the WEF Fest, but there's so much going on. I won't storyboard right now. I had some John Nichols because he does say some stuff at the end of this interview. What are the guardrails that exist now? A series that Brian Edwards Tiekert has been doing about media and the importance. Talks about Ben Bagdikian, if you will, the early author of warnings about concentration of media. The Media Monopoly was his book, and between the time it was written and went to press, concentration had increased, and it's only gotten worse. So here's part of the interview about a successful campaign, I guess, inside Microsoft to stop the Israelis from using a program called Azure. I'll let him explain it. This, again, is a web exclusive, not on the air. WEF.org, 359-9338. I guess I could take a pledge over the phone. Really important that you support community media now more than ever, as I like to say.
Here. Okay, let's. All right, you'll be next.
Thank you for your presentation.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Microsoft has blocked Israel's use of its technology for mass surveillance of Palestinians. This follows a protest campaign and investigations into how Microsoft let Israel's military surveillance agency use its Azure cloud storage platform to store millions of phone calls collected from Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. The Guardian, 972 magazine, and DropSite News have all published exposés on Microsoft's work with the Israeli military. This is Smith speaking in August in response to the mass protests at Microsoft offices.
The vast majority of what Microsoft does for the Israeli military, the Israeli Defense Force, is protect the cybersecurity of the state of Israel. Other activities as well that involve the use of Azure for storage, for example, for processing of data. And that is what we are focused on getting to the bottom of.
That's Microsoft President Brad Smith in August, after protesters with the No Azure for Apartheid launched an encampment at the company's headquarters in Redmond, Washington.
We are bringing the movement to the heart of this campus because this profiteering company is sitting on mounds of hundreds of thousands of Palestinian corpses.
That's Hossam Nasser, an organizer with No Azure for Apartheid and a former Microsoft worker who was fired last October after organizing a vigil outside Microsoft headquarters for Palestinians killed by Israel's military in Gaza. He joins us now from Seattle, Washington. Hossam, thanks so much for being with us. Can you respond to Microsoft's decision and what exactly that decision does and doesn't do?
Yeah, so Microsoft yesterday made a pretty significant, unprecedented move and a win for the campaign when they became the first U.S. company, the first U.S. tech company, to withdraw some of the services that they're providing for the Israeli military. When they withheld some of the cloud services, particularly storage and AI, that they were providing to Unit 8200, the Israeli spy agency, that was found after evidence was found that it was being used for mass surveillance of Palestinians. This move is unprecedented, and it's a significant win, not only because Microsoft becomes the first U.S. company to do so, but also because it comes in a context in which we see the tech industry in general is sliding more and more into collaborating with fascism, with authoritarianism, with Zionism, with some of the most evil forces in the world. We saw recently how Google was found to have signed a $50 million deal with the Israeli government to promote Israeli talking points. We saw recently Uber invested in Israeli drone technology. And we see Palantir collaborating with ICE to facilitate deportations. So for us in this context, to claw back a sense of normalcy, a sense of morality from these tech companies, and for it to come from one of the most valuable companies on earth, is vindicating to the organizing that we're doing and is a testament that we do not have to resign to the status quo. We do not have to resign to those people in power. But at the same time, we have to be very sober about what this isn't, right? This isn't the historic, complete severance of ties between Microsoft and the Israeli military that we had been campaigning for the past 2 years and that over 2,100 Microsoft workers had signed a petition calling for. What this really does is it only stops a single unit in the Israeli military, which is Unit 8200, from using only some of the services that Microsoft provides. Unit 8200 might be the most intrusive unit that Microsoft collaborates with, but it's probably not the most deadly. We know from reporting that Microsoft also sells technology directly to naval, air, and ground military units in Israel. We also know that they even send workers to embed within those units, and they were described as behaving as if they were soldiers themselves. So this is definitely not the end of our fight. And I think for us, it's also important to realize, like I said, it's only a partial win. To use an analogy, and I'm not very good with metaphors, but if I was making knives and I was selling you my knives and I later find out and I see that you're using these knives to kill children and gouge their eyes out, and I see evidence of you using my knives to do that, and then I only stop selling you one of my knives to only one of your limbs, that's definitely not enough. And that's what Microsoft has done with this announcement.
You know, it was very interesting to see Brad Smith in August when you had the protests and the occupation of his office, the president of Microsoft, say, OK, they're going to do a review. Is that when you were arrested? Were you arrested inside his office?
I was arrested twice last month, actually. So I was arrested in his office probably an hour before he came on and had that press conference. I was also arrested a week prior as well when we launched the Liberated Zone encampment on Microsoft campus. And I was arrested then as well. When you showed the clip earlier, that was on the first day of the encampment. And then we came back the second day. And on the second day, we were also violently arrested.
What do you think made Brad Smith say they will start this review and now today's announcement? Did you ever end up talking to him? I mean, you worked for Microsoft.
I worked for Microsoft for 3 years. I never had the disprivilege of talking to Brad Smith. But I will say that there is no doubt that the announcement today and the investigation that started in August, and even the first investigation that they launched and announced in May, were all a direct result of our organizing and our relentless activism around this issue. Microsoft, from the beginning, their strategy was to just ignore and silence our organizing. They tried repeatedly to ignore us for over a year of our organizing. And when our protests became unavoidable, especially after some of the more high-profile disruptions that we did, they were forced to come with the announcement that they made on Nakba Day on May 15 this year, announcing the results of their first investigation, which was basically said that they found no evidence of wrongdoing. They've investigated themselves and found no wrongdoing. That was mere days before our scheduled protest at Microsoft Build, which was one of its most high-profile conferences of the year. It was clearly an attempt for them to try to stop our protests. And when that didn't work, and especially when more news came out that directly refuted their claims on May 15, I think, again, they tried to preemptively try to stop some of our protests by making this announcement that the second investigation was going to be started. And we launched shortly after, we launched the Liberated Zone encampment. We occupied Brad Smith's office. And less than a month later, Brad Smith comes out and with this announcement. So it's very clear that the only reason that Microsoft ever even tried to make this investigation or take this significant step this week is because of our organizing and our activism.
One of the reporters who covered the mass protests in August at Microsoft's headquarters in Redmond, Washington, was the editor of the Real News Network, Maximilian Alvarez. He shared a video of what happened after he was covering the protests.
So I'm walking back to my car after covering the encampment and the police breaking up the encampment at Microsoft's headquarters. And as I walk back to my car, I can literally hear one of these drones buzzing above my head right now.
So that's Maximilian Alvarez, the editor of the Real News Network. And he said he was being followed by drones. Hossam, do you know about this?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it's par for the course for how Microsoft has reacted to our protests. Funny enough, just the same week that we occupied Brad Smith's office, myself and a couple other former Microsoft workers, we went back to campus to simply table on public property away from Microsoft campus, and we were simply just handing out flyers to workers. And Microsoft security immediately started barricading the bridge that we were on. They sent, as far as I could count, at least 8 security workers to follow us around, and they even sent the Redmond police. I saw at least 3 police cars, including a police van. I saw the drone homing above us as well, simply for workers who are flying on public property. So I think that really shows how scared they are of our organizing, how scared they are of our movement. And also, like I said, they have always been resorting to brute force, to repression, to silencing as a response to our organizing. And this isn't new. This is to be expected. If we ever get to a point of challenging those in power, they will respond with repression. If anything, if we're not facing repression, we're not challenging them enough. But as it stands, it's never going to work. It hasn't worked. They've done this in the past. They've continued to do this, and we know they will do this in the future as well. But every single time, they've tried to fire our workers, they've tried to silence us, they've tried to intimidate us. Our organizing has only gotten stronger, more loud, more bold, and we've continued our escalations. And now they're trying a new strategy of trying to give us a little bone, hoping that they will shut us up. But we've been very clear from the beginning that the only way that we will stop our organizing is once all of our demands are met completely.
Can you explain?
That's, again, Hossam Nasr from a web exclusive. I'm going to encourage you to hear the rest of it, Amy's question. But I think I want to hear some John Nichols. It's a pledge drive after all. He wrote Media and Democracy with the late, great Bob McChesney, an issue that talks about concentration of media. Actually, I guess I'm going to foreshadow that with the new way that media is controlled, the algorithm. This is from something I hope to play in its entirety, but I'll get to a portion of it. But I wanted to make sure this part got on while I was talking about media and democracy, so why not hear it now?
It's an attempt to prevent people, especially young people, from communicating about Palestine. The ADL last year said we have a Gen Z problem with TikTok, and they solved it they're trying to solve it by gutting TikTok of Palestinian content and making it suppress a speech that's critical of Israel, as most other big tech platforms have done.
Sam Husseini from the Monday edition, a regular update on genocide. But let's get to John Nichols from another favorite producer of mine. This is Brian Edwards Tiekert, who also does the freestanding show called Corona Calls, which I didn't hear this week's episode. That also drops on a Monday. Upfront is the name of the program, and that's also available directly as a podcast. I'm going to probably break away with this from this. I'm going to slew forward, come to think of it. This is John Nichols.
There was apparently more widespread popular revulsion at the prospect of a government official basically ordering a TV host off the air than there was loyalty to any given TV host. That the American public doesn't like the idea of government interference in the operations of the media.
Mm-hmm. No, and they shouldn't. I mean, obviously, the founders of the American experiment, in part because they were recognized that if you didn't have a free press, that you moved very quickly toward a monarchical or at least a potentially authoritarian system. It made it much easier for the person in power to wield that power without the informed consent of the people. So that's kind of a constant. Something, you know, as imperfect as our civic education may be, most people got out of their, you know, whatever hour or so that some or a few hours that educators spent on the Constitution. And so if we understand that, yeah, people have an instinctual revulsion to that. Two things also, Brian, that I think are important to what you're communicating here. First off, yeah, viewership of late night television, viewership of a lot of television has gone down as we've, you know, turned into a country where you have digital streaming services that communicate so much of our information and entertainment. But still, you can make a good profit off a well-managed late night TV show. Don't mourn for these people too much. There is still at least some viewership. And these shows also have a lot of influence with the people who go to bed early, but then during the following day, catch a clip or hear a line or, you know, you see, you know, elements of the show kind of communicate through the day. So in many ways, like the traditional daily newspaper in a community, they do serve a role, or they have served a role in communicating about, you know, the news of the day or how we respond to it. They do so in a funny way, but at the end of the discussion, they've communicated some attitude. And in many senses, even into the current moment, they have been seen as sort of like a good measure of where sentiment really is, you know, not the Democratic senator complaining about Trump or whatever, but the late night host just, you know, throwing up a line that mocks something the president or somebody else has done. And so there's still a role for these late night shows. And when you mess with them, I think people who don't even watch them kind of instinctually recognize, wow, this is some element of shutting down the discourse.
Funny you should bring up the clip propagation machine that is social media.
Yeah.
Because there was another piece of media news that didn't get quite the same treatment as the Jimmy Kimmel about face this week. The Trump administration has announced it's got, I guess, what we would call the beginnings of a deal over the fate of TikTok, the video-based social media platform. There's a congressional mandate to require ByteDance, the owner of TikTok, to sever its U.S. operations from Chinese control. The Trump administration has issued a lot of extensions it didn't really have the authority to issue, and now has announced it has brokered a deal by which, for a large sum of money, control over the U.S. version of TikTok will be in the hands of right-wing multi-billionaire Larry Ellison of Oracle, his son, mm-hmm. and also there will be a minority stake from the Murdoch family. What do we think of this news?
Well, I mean, remember, it looks like the original owners are still going to have some stake as well. You know, smaller, they want to have majority stake, but you're going to see, for all the complaints about, you know, foreign ownership and stuff like that, there's still elements of it, you know, in this mix, at least in some arrangements of the deal. What do I make of that? Look, I mean, the White House of the United States ought not be brokering the sale of media platforms, right? I mean, we're now in a situation where power rests in the platforms. It doesn't rest, you know, in the individual network or the individual content creator. You may have a content creator who's very, you know, influential and contributes a lot to the discourse. I think of somebody like Jon Stewart, you know, with an outsized influence that I think is, frankly, to my mind, very healthy, and others. But at the end of the day, it's the platform that matters, because that's where the, you know, all of this sort of aggregated information comes in. And, you know, as we have heard many complaints and many concerns, can be accelerated or decelerated. There's all sorts of concerns about how algorithms work. And then there's the whole overlay of concerns about social media in general, which even conservative Republican politicians are talking about. And so to have the President of the United States or the White House and its signs kind of organizing ownership shifts is unsettling in and of itself. Just as it is concerning when allies of the president or allies of those in power purchase a platform. It's what you saw with Elon Musk purchasing Twitter, now X. And so we end up in a situation where I think our media, our major media today, and I'm talking about folks, media critics, people who cover the media landscape, lose sight of the fact that we have really entered into platform wars, right? You know, the struggle to create and own platforms. And so this TikTok deal is one where we ought to all be pulling the brakes, right? Everybody who talks about media, and we ought to be having a very, very serious discussion about how this is happening and who it's being turned over to, or how it's ending up in particular hands. Because, Brian, if all or most of our platforms, our major platforms, are owned by very conservative, very corporate individuals, folks who really are interested, as in another example, as Jeff Bezos of Amazon says, where he now wants the Washington Post to be editorially, you know, very sympathetic to corporate power, very sympathetic to, you know, kind of elite business arrangements. If that's what we end up with as, you know, kind of our entry points in so much of our media, you don't just have a problem with Donald Trump, right? You know, I mean, and what he may think. You have a problem with a discussion about, you know, who controls our economy, who controls our politics, and a host of related issues. And at a time when there is so much outcry about affordability, about, you know, corporate overreach, about inequality, to have our major platforms owned by people that don't seem to be particularly concerned about that. And you know, perhaps they will be free-ranging and open and wonderful, but, you know, it is legitimate to worry. It is exceptionally legitimate to worry about media ownership. That's what Bob McChesney and I have argued before Bob's passing, but we argued for decades, and I continue to argue it, as does Craig Aaron, and as do people like Zephyr Teachout and others. In fact, frankly, most of the people who worry about, to my mind, who worry about this intersection of media and democracy, worry at the most fundamental level about ownership and about who controls now the platform.
So here's my big picture concern, John. Jimmy Kimmel was not like a raging progressive on the airwaves. People rallied to his defense out of free speech concerns. TikTok had an opaque algorithm for recommending content. There's considerable evidence that it is one of the reasons young people turned so hard and so fast against Israel's invasion of Gaza, because footage from Gaza was able to make it out over that platform. But also reporting in recent weeks that TikTok's already started downranking that kind of content to get ready for this kind of deal. And one presumes if the Ellisons are in charge of it, a lot of Gaza footage is going to disappear entirely from that platform. The media democracy movement's been pretty good at kicking up a fuss about things getting worse, against consolidation, against authoritarian government interventions in the media. But it doesn't feel like there's an affirmative set of demands for a better media system that's been able to get any kind of traction.
Yes, I think you're exactly right. And I say that as somebody who's been deeply committed to media and democracy movements and activism for a long time. And the thing, decades ago,
Bob and I argued that for us to get to the place where we needed to be, media itself had to become an issue, right? There had to be something that was debated and that was discussed. The media and democracy movement has worked very hard in that regard and has had some successes along the way, defending net neutrality at critical stages now, you know, obviously an ongoing struggle, but defending net neutrality, battling successfully against moves toward corporate consolidation during some of the Bush years. And you know, some minimal progress, some maybe even more progress on some issues during the Obama years, but we remain in a deep, deep fundamental struggle to communicate to the great mass of Americans that media should be an issue, that it should be an issue that they understand something that they ought to have a say regarding. And most of our debates about media and democracy are reduced to, you know, like a, you know, the what was the annual fight over NPR, right? And public broadcasting, which now we've, you know, gone into a whole new stage of. But the deeper discussion about media ownership, and frankly, you know, where our media ought to go has never been fully realized. Part of the problem there is that media companies are hugely profitable and they are highly engaged in our politics. We often talk about media as something that, you know, you watch or you listen to or you read or whatever. Media companies and the bigger companies that own them have lobbyists. Right. And they have interests that intersect with our politics. They also have an ability to influence politics in a lot of ways. And so where we found a real gap is not just with Republicans, but also with many, many Democrats. They have been unwilling to take these issues up and talk about them in fundamental ways that communicate well. A exception to the rule is Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders has been talking about media consolidation, media ownership for decades. And when he talks about it, as he often does in front of crowds of, you know, 5, 8, 10, 20, 30,000 people, and gives it, you know, 3 minutes of discussion, the crowd is with him, right? They get it, and they, you know what I mean? You can communicate there. The trouble is that we, as an example in this country, have never really had a Democratic presidential candidate at the nominee level who has talked about this in, you know, major ways, has given major speeches on this, has made it a part of debates. And unfortunately, a part of that is that both in the Democratic and the Republican Party, I think more in some ways the Democratic Party now, there's a desire to, you know, keep on friendly terms with the media, right? Not to attack and criticize. And the way it should work is the way that I'll give you a good example. When Sanders went to, when Sanders went to the New York Times editorial board to try and, you know, show up as all the candidates did to get endorsements in, I think, 2019, Sanders said up front, look, I know you guys don't really like me all that much. I got to tell you, you know, I'm not going to send you birthday cards and, you know, holiday greetings and stuff like that. I don't like the coziness between political figures and media. And if more people were doing that, I think that folks, a greater number of Americans would understand this as a political issue. But, you know, that reality exists. And so we who are media reformers have every reason to up the volume, to do everything we can to try and build this movement, as difficult as it may be, because it as Ben Bagdikian, who spent a lot of his life on this radio station, I think, over the years, as Ben Bagdikian taught us, you know, better part of 50 years ago, until we make this an issue, those in power are going to keep creating an intersect between media and power that serves profits, but that does not serve democracy.
Ben Bagdikian, former dean of the UC Berkeley Journalism School, and one of the first writers to raise concerns about the consolidation of media ownership. John Nichols.
And John Nichols didn't mention that Sanders started his career in the public by being a producer at a public access TV channel in Burlington, Vermont. So, yeah. Obviously, one thing you can do is support your community media. Please do. You can go to WEF.org. I'm a little too flustered right now. I won't be getting to promote the Friday Forum segment, which got into a discussion of what ended the Vietnam War. Was it activism at home, or was it the resistance of the Vietnamese people? It's a false dichotomy, it seems to me. And the thing in the middle of that was the revolt by soldiers, discussion of fragging with Bob Case. Bob Case grew up partially in Germany, in Wiesbaden, which is where the hospitals are. And off the recording, He said that he was in the hospital once for a checkup or something, and he was talking to some GIs in the waiting line, and most of them had been fragged. They had been shot or injured by their own soldiers when the soldiers didn't like an order they were given. The half-life of the second lieutenant was not very long. All right, just about 10 minutes of the discussion with Sam Husseini is what we have time for. This is from, again, the Monday Flashpoints. If you want to hear the discussion in full, don't forget WEFFest tomorrow. I'm preempted. It's from 2 to 6. The KTEL's blues band, but they're going to have an augmented brass section. I'm interested to see who's going to show up for that. That's, I believe, the closing act. Go to WEFF.org when you're making your pledge, and you can get the rundown of what's happening on at the Seven Saints right next door tomorrow. Hope the weather is as pleasant as it is today. I think it is going to be, but cross fingers. So about 9 minutes of Dennis Bernstein. There's actually another person here identified as well who I think he has flotilla news, Sumud flotilla. Oh, and I didn't drop in what I was thinking about. Italy hasn't gone and joined the recognition thing that Macron started, but they have sent a boat actually joining Spain and accompanying the flotilla. I have been thinking about the latest Pope, is it Leo, visit to Lebanon and whether he could do a flyby. And then I thought, well, maybe he could just fly to Cyprus and join the flotilla for a bit. But yeah, that's just me.
Today we would return to a conversation we've been perennially...
Two Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We begin our show as we do every Monday with our special segment. We call it Genocide Watch. And of course, we're talking about at this point the U.S. armed and supported ongoing genocide in Gaza and the West Bank. Let's not forget the West Bank, 8 times the size of Gaza and under siege and attack as well. Joining us as he does every week, and we appreciate him, is Sam Husseini. He is a special contributor to this program and has been doing some great work for us when we can manage to track down State Department people having a meeting and ask him a question or two. Sam, welcome back to Flashpoints. Gotta start, as we always do, with Gaza. Dozens more killed. There is no end to the killing. It worries me, Sam, that people are getting hard to the level of violence because I'm hearing less and less talk about it in the corporate mainstream. Not that there was much there to begin with.
There's been a complete normalization of genocide, which is an appalling thing to say. I think that there have been systematic ways that that's been done by the establishment. They put in a phony ceasefire that was designed to fail as just as Trump was coming into office, so that the media lens would shift off of Gaza to the extent that it was there and onto Trump and his, you know, he's just a distraction machine a good deal of the time. Israeli forces have killed at least 61 Palestinians in Gaza over the last 24 hours. Trump just prepared a $6 billion additional weapons package for Israel, paid for by your U.S. tax dollars. The U.S. is disputing that its citizens were killed in Lebanon. It won't even stand by its own citizens when it comes to Israel over and over again. And last Thursday evening, I believe, the U.S. Issued its sixth veto of a ceasefire resolution at the U.N. Security Council, which kind of brings us to the, you know, coming U.N. The big high-level meetings. It's the 80th session of the U.N. Security Council coming up, opening tomorrow. I'm going to be on with Craig Mochaber, who's been on this program, and a couple of other great folks, some volunteers at StopGenocide.com are organizing a live stream so that we can sort of debunk what different, what Trump, he'll be the second or the second speaker from a nation state to speak tomorrow morning, but a whole bunch of other speakers are going to speak. You'll have the UN Secretary General speaking. He has refused to call Israel's genocide a genocide. I just watched a good chunk of a speech that he made today in which he can't even bring himself to say Israel. He just simply says, oh, these terrible things are happening in Gaza without naming the perpetrator. He has no problem naming Hamas as the perpetrator of the October 7th attacks, mind you, but he has a hard time getting it out of his mouth that Israel is slaughtering people on a daily basis. And he has not, as a matter of policy, he's refused to say the word genocide. Even after the recent UN commission put out a fairly strong report, I think it had some flaws, but it was a fairly strong report, and it basically urged UN officials to use the term genocide. And it also reminded all UN member states that they were put on notice the moment that South Africa filed its lawsuit at the International Court of Justice invoking the Genocide Convention. And then when the ICJ issued its provisional orders in January of 2024, all of these countries were put on notice that they were under a legal obligation under the Genocide Convention. It's a convention to punish and prevent genocide. It's a special convention in that sense. It puts a moral, it puts a legal obligation, not just a moral obligation, a legal obligation on states to act, and they haven't acted. Some have issued good statements, you know, if you go through the record of, you know, country after country, they have not done what they need to do. I don't know if we have Rob with us. He's done incredible work on this.
We do, but I just want to say one other thing about the bottom line before we take our spotlight off the direct suffering. I think we have to keep repeating the brutality that surrounds this so-called, they call it a feeding program. It's a starvation program in which Palestinians are drawn into a crossfire and then murdered without any questions being asked. It is an extraordinary situation that they can continue to use food as bait and then use the Palestinians as target practice. This continues.
Absolutely. And you see report after report from doctors in Gaza saying how, you know, they're having, you know, children that are dying of headshots. I've even seen some reports from doctors that, like, on a given day, you know, it's headshots, and on another day it's groin shots, and another day it's chest shots. So it's like they're doing target practice on each day. Like, you know, the so-called soldiers are saying, what body part will we hit today? They're obviously using food as a weapon. They're starving the people of Gaza. And they're, you know, some of their right-wing ministers are outright saying, hip, hip, hooray. They've detained and imprisoned doctors, heads of hospitals, and so on. They've decimated virtually every hospital in Gaza. It's clearly a systematic genocide, and that's been clear for some time. I think some people are acknowledging it now very belatedly, sort of as a, you know, attempt to wash their hands of it so that they can say that they said something. But even people who have been saying something are not acting in accord with their legal and other obligations. And of course, Israel has systematically killed journalists. So you're seeing more and more reports of people saying there's an increased number of killings, but a decreased number of videos of the carnage because Israel has systematically killed the messengers. That's one way to fix.
It's so obvious, you know, that has been the modus operandi.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a unique situation. The amount of journalists, there's all kinds of figures.
Yeah, and then a whole bunch of in Yemen all at once. They had a studio. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. I guess I need to play another underwriting announcement. They're getting some work done on their building next door. Come down and check out WEF. Don't check out their construction site, but be careful, I guess. Always say that. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting community media. That, again, was Sam Husseini in conversation with Dennis Bernstein. They were joined by someone else. You can find that past Monday, and he'll be back next Monday as well. Genocide Watch. Okay, let's see.
Support for WEFT programming is made possible in part by Bash Pepper Roofing. Large or small, they cover them all, commercial or residential. Bash Pepper Roofing offers roofing and re-roofing, gutters, siding, and door needs. For more information, 217-352-2200 or online at bashpepper.com.
So this is another rebroadcast of Radio Free Labor. Gus has been down in his hometown at Atlanta. I was saying last week I'd hope he'll do a report back from this massive conference.